Babylon Podcast was our last best hope for B5 fans. A self-contained show, 1 hour long, located on an RSS feed. A place for interviews and episode discussions for a whole bunch of humans and aliens. A shining beacon in cyberspace, all alone on the web. It was the dawn of the third age of podcasting, the year the Lost Tales came upon us all. This is the podcast about the story of the last of the Babylon stations. The year is 2007. The name of the show is the Babylon Podcast.
And welcome back to the Babylon Podcast. I am Summer Brooks.
I'm Tim Callender.
And it is the new and improved Jeffrey calling from the brand spanking minute. You hear the phones are already ringing in the background there. This is the new Farpoint Media Studios here in Los Angeles. And the phones are going wild. I wonder if that's – should I take our first request and see who it is?
Oh, wow. Yeah, absolutely.
Hold on. All right, wait. I got to put this down and move over here.
The contests are started. The phones are calling. People are calling in now.
Well, Summer, you're back.
I am.
We're so happy to have you back.
Okay. See that? It's paying off. I was an high-powered executive from Fox Television calling.
Wanting to put a show on for you?
I don't think he quite made the connection between what was going on at the moment, and so I just blew him off. You know,
that's all right. He'd buy your show only to cancel it before it aired.
No, he's one of the good ones, actually. He's a good one.
Oh, good.
I'm excited. This is so cool. I can't wait for you guys to come to L.A., and we'll do a show from here.
Great. You going to fly us out?
As soon as Mike lets me have the keys back to the jet.
I think we should have a recording session to celebrate PME.
Oh, ooh, there you go. That's a good idea.
Good idea.
Yeah. It is a good idea.
That is what I think.
The Farpoint Studios are really nowhere near where PME is, so.
No, okay. But we can drive an extra hour.
We could do that. That would be cool. I was in Phoenix, for those who didn't know. I was in Phoenix over the weekend and came back yesterday. Yeah, late last night.
Last night, yeah.
And was out there to do a Wingin' It on Saturday and have some fun and dinner and libation with my best pals, Summer and Mike. We had a good time. I enjoy going back to Phoenix, and I think I'm going to be coming back there again real soon.
Cool.
Very cool.
And Tim, I got to hold in my hand. Summer actually looked the other way for a split second, and I was able to grab the Lost Tales DVD and at least look at it. I got to read it.
Oh, that's not being fair.
And then it was gone again, and I got some.
Well, I do have to give special thanks for a gift Jeff gave me while he was here. And he scared me at first because he said, okay, close your eyes and hold out your hand.
Oh, I'd be very, very frightened.
So I was a little worried at first. But he gave me a piece of one of the Kosh heads that was blown up on the show.
Cool.
So I have a piece of Kosh.
Just as long as it's not inside your head, I think you'll be just fine.
Oh, I wasn't supposed to sew that onto the back of my neck? Okay.
Yeah, there are a lot of girls in South Hollywood that actually have a piece of Kosh, too, so.
Oh, that's just wrong.
Wow, that
Ouch.
Is so wrong.
Ouch.
Well, hey, if you're saying ouch, then you haven't used the Astroglide.
Ooh.
No. The Koshaglide, no. I do have the piece, and I'm going to, find that little box to, frame it in or something and put it with the rest of my B5 memorabilia, because so far that's the coolest one I have.
That is pretty cool. It is cool. Pretty cool.
That's
well,
great.
The other cool thing, of course, is that Lost Tales, well, by the time you hear this, Lost Tales will have been released. But Summer, you got the pre-release copy, and
I
you
do.
Viewed it.
I do. And you will be viewing it tomorrow.
That's right. I believe the Rangers are dispatching a White Star to pick it up.
Yes, they are. And for our listeners, a very special deep geeking, solely dedicated to the Lost Tales will be going out in a separate show on the feed. Let's see, this is going out on August 1st, so probably August 2nd or August 3rd, you will hear that special show. And if you don't want spoilers, you can skip it and listen to it later. But we're not going to spoil the Lost Tales in the main show.
Right.
We're gonna spare all of our listeners from that torture or that teasing as much as we can.
Wash dies. Oh, wait a second.
Wouldn't that be Kosh dies?
Yeah, that already happened.
So very, very exciting. Very, very exciting.
I also got the final details on the signing that is going on. And if you let me run to the other side of the ivory tower here, I'll get the information for you here.
Okay, Mike, insert the Foley of footsteps here.
You have to talk to Brad about that, because Brad's actually doing all the post-production.
That's true.
Doing a damn fine job, too, if I might say.
Yes, he has been.
He's lost in the studio.
That's
it's too big.
Now, see, this is a real vault.
Yes, it is.
A real tour of the vault here.
There you go.
Okay, here it is. Here's the information.
It was right next to the Ark of the Covenant.
Yeah, I'm back. Okay, now, let's see if I can see that. That's too far away. Okay. So the media advisory was sent to me, along with our invitation for me to go down and interview J. Michael Straczynski, Bruce Boxleitner, Tracy Scoggins, and Peter Woodward, when they greet fans and sign copies of Babylon 5, The Lost Tales at Best Buy West Hollywood on Tuesday, July 31st.
Very cool.
Yeah. And let's see. The Best Buy is, for those in the area who are interested, is 1015 North La Brea in West Hollywood. Dangerously close to the tar pit. Dangerously close to the tar pit. And, which is where Joe will probably send me as soon as I'm done trying to interview him for the Babylon podcast. But, the other thing that's whammy jammy cool about this is that they were kind enough to tell me it was okay for me to bring my high definition camera. So I'm going to be shooting these interviews as well. And it'll be determined what we do with that video, if we can make that available, you know, on our site here. But for sure, I can pull off the audio clips and we'll be able to spit those out. Or hopefully in the next week or two, or maybe we'll spread them out a little bit so that we can milk this whole thing as long as we possibly can.
Very good. Very cool.
Okay, the chat room is yelling at me, begging to know if the DVD is in HD. And it doesn't say HD, so I'm going to guess no.
It's not an HD DVD. It's a standard DVD.
It's a standard DVD.
Who's that? Is that Brian?
No,
that's Tim.
Oh, Tim. Tim.
Tim Squared.
Yeah.
Yes. Tim Squared, yes. Hi, Tim. Didn't know you were in there.
I missed the intros.
You didn't miss much.
You missed all the fun, then.
Well, no, it was, you know, like last week. I just didn't say anything.
Alrighty, then.
He's a lurker.
Yes, he is a lurker. He's a lurker.
So, Summer, come on, cut the crap. You know, like on a scale of 1 to 10.
I would give this a strong 7.5, 8.
Okay.
Yes.
Very good.
It's fair. To compare it with previous standalone projects, it is 10 times better than Legend of the Rangers. I would rank it. I liked Call to Arms. A lot of people didn't really like what Call to Arms did. I did, but I put this right around there.
Call to Arms. I mean, Call to Arms as a standalone movie was a very good pilot for Crusade. I didn't have any issues with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but some people didn't like it. I'm like, what was there not to like?
Yeah.
You know, you had fisticuffs, you had intrigue.
Right.
You had Garibaldi.
Yeah, right.
Well, it very much was a gateway to Crusade, though.
It was. It was a gateway to Crusade. But a lot of the, you know, as something that had a story that didn't have to keep going.
Yeah.
Yeah, pretty good.
Yeah.
And this has stuff that could be followed up easily enough or not. And I was just telling, there's two stories. The first story, I didn't understand where it was going. But when it took that left turn to Albuquerque that I totally didn't see coming, I was like, oh, cool.
Okay.
And the second story was just cool from the very outset because it had Galen in it. And I have to warn people now. The extras run longer than the actual main content.
Really?
Yes. I couldn't stay up any longer. I was falling asleep. My exhaustion kicked in. Literally, round kicked me in the back of the head, and I still had 15 little fireside chats to watch.
So, are they all just interviews, or is it behind the scenes stuff?
It's behind the scenes stuff. And as I was telling Tim earlier, sometime in 2006, Stress grabbed JMS by the back of the neck and shook him around a little bit because he had a very amusing but also at the same time frightening obsession with sock puppets. And you have to see it for yourself. It's funny. It's very, very funny. I knew where he was going with that.
It's a mental break of some sort?
No, he was just, I don't know. Can I give away spoilers to the extras?
Sure, why not?
No, of course not.
Okay.
Wow.
I don't know. He wanted to shoot the entire movie in sock puppets, and he even did a promo, like a pitch with sock puppets to a Warner Brothers executive.
Oh, my God, that's great.
And that's hilarious. That I was crying laughing. I'm like, where did this come from? And then you had Peter Woodward commenting on his, sock puppet, I don't know, doppelganger.
How do you make a bald sock?
No, it had a hood. It had a hood. It had a hood. It had, Galen's cloak and the piercing eyes that were blue X's.
The piercing eyes.
The little blue X's. And it's just, and there's this little sock puppet theme running through all the little extras of his, and it's just so cute. And then afterwards, I was going, "Oh my God, was he having a break right there, and nobody noticed?" But it was all good. It was all good.
That's fun. Yes. That's fun. Well, I love the video blogs that they did during the shoot, and Doug Netter, what a who he is, because he just played the whole crusty old man thing. not so much everybody was sucking up with JMS, but some of their banter was expected. But he was just like, I don't even know how to describe it. JMS would come along saying, "Here's our producer, Doug Netter," and he would just like drop some. I've been around the block. I don't need this kind of crap sort of comment. It was really funny.
Unbelievable.
Well, that's great. I'm glad we're finally at this point. It's been, we've been talking about it long enough.
Yeah, it's here. It's here.
And it's finally here, and we'll finally get through this phase, and then we'll have to figure out what we're going to promo for the next 8 months.
Exactly.
Cool.
All right. Well, should we take a break now, you think?
We shall. We will come back with some deep geeking on the episode Passing Through Gethsemane.
Hi, this is Doc from Des Moines. My real name is Dr. Alan Koslow, and I'm a surgeon in Des Moines and obviously a sci-fi freak. I'm also the director of the blood drive at the Dragon Con, the Heinlein's blood drive at Dragon Con. I'm going to be making this blood drive dedicated to Joe, and so I was wondering if you could do the shout out on all of the Farpoint programs and say everybody going to Dragon Con. If you do normally give blood, hold off for the 6th between now and Dragon Con so that you're able to give blood at Dragon Con. And if you don't give blood, think about giving blood at Dragon Con. Everyone who donates blood at Dragon Con is going to get a ribbon that says, "I gave blood for Joe." Just to let you know, patients who have cancer probably use up more blood than any other category of patients. And patients like Joe need blood transfusions. And so in Joe's memory, let's go ahead and donate some blood at Dragon Con, and you'll get a ribbon saying, "I gave blood for Joe." Look forward to seeing you all at Dragon Con. Look me up at the blood drive and at the podcasting seminar, and look forward to seeing you all there. Thanks a lot.
Digging down to the obscurest facts in fandom, this is Deep Geeking.
And this week, we will be talking about a very interesting episode, Passing Through Gethsemane. I think the first time I saw it, I wasn't quite as taken by it as I was on later viewings. But, Tim, why don't you give us an overview?
Okay. Well, the overview is one of Brother Theo's Dominican monks, Brother Edward, is introduced to us, and he's a very kind, gentle soul. He is portrayed as being an individual who is more interested in giving and helping. It just seems to be, you know, a very, very gentle person. Captain Sheridan, in fact, seems very taken with him, very touched by his humility and sincerity. However, strange goings-on begin to happen around Brother Edward. He begins to see lurid writing and blood on the walls of his quarters. Death walks among us. He starts hearing voices. He keeps finding black roses near his things dropped off in mysterious places. And as he goes forward, he realizes there's something not right here, and does a little investigation on his own, only to discover that he was, prior to this, a serial killer, the Black Rose Killer. And for his punishment, he was mind-wiped. He was given a new personality, and that personality became Brother Edward. And at this point, Brother Edward knows that, you know, he feels as though he is carrying great sin. He wonders what other sins he has committed that he doesn't know about, and is basically looking for absolution. As we discover what has basically broken the mind wipe is that the people who are the relatives of the Black Rose Killer's victims have hired a Centauri telepath to break down the barriers on the mind wipe. And they eventually basically do a lynching. Brother Edward dies getting absolution from Brother Theo. And then at the end, Captain Sheridan, who is wondering about the nature of forgiveness and you know, how despite what he might have done, Brother Edward, you know, as the Black Rose Killer, Brother Edward was a great person. And then at that point, Captain Sheridan is then introduced to Brother Malcolm, a new member of the Order, who has just joined them under extenuating circumstances. And, of course, he turns out to be the individual who is instrumental in killing Brother Edward in revenge. And Captain Sheridan basically has to come face to face with his own self-righteousness about the nature of forgiveness and realizes that he must forgive this individual. So that's the basic A story. Yeah. The other part of it, of course, is that Lita Alexander returns to the station. She said she'd be back, and she's back, and now running errands for Ambassador Kosh. And she provides some assistance to the command staff to discover where Brother Edward has been grabbed by these vigilantes, by basically busting apart the head, psychically busting apart the head of the Centauri telepath.
Yeah.
So that's kind of it in a nutshell. I'll say this, unlike you, Summer, I was really captivated by this episode the first time I saw it. And repeated viewings, while has kind of revealed a couple things that are a little iffy or questionable in how the story is told, the basic theme of it still resonates with me. And to me, this is a fine example of what science fiction can do, and not just Babylon 5, but I mean science fiction in general.
Right.
You know, it comes down to this. You know, you've got the science fiction element, you've got the element of the mind wipes and the telepaths, but what it does is, through that mechanism, forces us to confront the nature of forgiveness and sin and atonement. And that's one of the things that Brother Edward is trying to find. You know, there's that great scene after he's discovered that he was previously a Black Rose Killer, and Theo knows that he's probably figured it out. And there's a shot, the scene between Theo and Edward, and Edward is behind that metal barrier that almost looks like a cage. Mm-hmm. And Edward is saying, I found out what I am. How can I live with the knowledge of what I've done? And Theo was trying to tell him, look, you may not know, but God knows. And God knows and forgive you. And Edward says, is there enough forgiveness in the universe for what I've done? And Theo says, yes. But Edward doesn't accept that and basically gives himself up to sacrifice.
Mm-hmm. And I like how there's a thread of theological discussion that is interesting. It's intriguing. You don't expect it in a sci-fi show, but it's a great place for it in the terms of what they're talking about between just because the thing about mind wipes comes back around again. Mm-hmm. And what they're talking about actually echoes in what Theo has to go through. I mean, Edward, he's
right
sitting there. They're talking about Gethsemane, and he says, I don't know that I would have the strength to sit there when I know that they're coming for me. And then when he's actually being, I guess, comforted in his last moments, he says, I know what that feels like.
Right.
And that, I think that's where I changed my mind about the episode. Because up until that point, I was like, yeah, I see it, but I'm not really, I didn't feel it.
Oh, see, I was drawn in immediately.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, I was looking at it as not only do you have these deep religious figures who are sitting here talking theology the entire time,
mm-hmm.
but you've got this overcurrent on top of that of what's the difference between a person, his brain, his mind, and his spirit that's going on that exists almost on a completely different current than the theological questions that are going on, but yet they're all intertwined. I just thought it was masterfully done.
And the other part of it that I caught this viewing around is how much of that is still, no matter how you feel about your faith or God or theology, how much of it is still determined by an individual's own desire to find what they're looking for.
Right.
And again, that gets back to that scene I was referencing. Edward feels that in order to atone for his sins, he has to sacrifice. He has to give himself up to these people. He has to pass through Gethsemane. Theo, on the other hand, is telling him, no, look, you don't understand. You don't get it. This is what our faith says. God knows, and God forgives you. So come on back. It'll be fine.
Right.
But Edward doesn't hear that part. He hears, you know, only the part about, you know, about sin and how horrible that is. And you know what? I love the foreshadowing at the beginning with the chess match. And Ivanova and Edward are having the running commentary over Theo and Sheridan's game.
Right.
And Ivanova says, you know, would you care to put a wager on that? And Brother Edward says, that's a minor sin. And I've always felt if you're going to sin, you should go for the really big one.
Right.
And, of course, what do we find out? He's a serial killer.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's pretty big.
You know, part of the other thing is, as you mentioned, that whole discourse between Brother Theo sitting there saying, you know, no, 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 come back. And, you know, and Edward basically saying, I can't. That also kind of highlights almost the two sides you get into in between when you're dealing with two people of deep faith as well. Where you've got one who says, no, 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 you've got to do this ultimate sacrifice. And the other side of it saying, no, it doesn't matter what you do, you're constantly forgiven. You know, see, I mean, there's just all these multiple echoes throughout the entire thing of just these deep philosophical points.
Yeah, I really like it. And it always surprises me. JMS has gone on record as saying that he's an atheist. And yet he really has the knack for digging at those truths, but not with an agenda.
I don't, you know, think...
At no point does he ever point out, you know, have a character come along and say, you're all idiots because you believe in this God person or whatever.
Right.
Like you pointed out, Tim, he's basically sides.
Well, yeah, and he's dealing with both sides of the issue from a theological perspective, mm-hmm. which I'm kind of the belief that you really can't be an atheist without at least understanding quite a bit about religion. You know, or about theology,
right.
You know, because just to say I don't believe this, if you haven't done, if you're going to go by logic, if you don't know the other side of the argument, you're throwing just as much blind faith into it.
Mm-hmm.
So this episode, it really is. Atheism at that point becomes a religion.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I agree.
And so this right here, I think, just shows a great breadth of that argument as well. It's, look, I can speak about this from both sides of the issue.
And say, I don't think... I think atheist is the wrong description because you can have faith. You can have a spiritual side. You can be spiritual and not fall into lockstep with any organized religion. If anything, you know, my point of view, organized religion is the exact opposite antithesis of spirituality, because it's about bringing you farther away than it is about bringing you closer.
But you're talking,
that's just me.
But you're talking at that point agnosticism, which is an atheism basically is life starts, life ends, and everything in the middle is what happens, and that's it. You're done.
All right. He might have believed that now, but the way he wrote a lot of these theological, philosophical discussions that literally are infused, they are part of the soul of the story of Babylon 5. He at some point had to do some spiritual searching, either through research for a story or through personal experience. He may not believe that anymore, but at some point in time, he had to have been there.
Right, but these are themes that are echoed throughout mythology for thousands of years as well. You know, and it's one of the things we do with these large epic tales is we go through and we retell them in a way to make them contemporary to our time. You know, and so I think if you go through and you're a study, Joseph Campbell, for example, you know, goes through and he studies these mythologies and looks over at them and looks for these recurring themes. You know, and there's a guy who really doesn't have that much spirituality, but his entire study is religion. You know, so I think it's entirely possible for someone to maintain pure atheism, you know, entirely, but yet understand the other side and be able to speak with knowledge from that.
All right.
Yeah. And I think that's JMS's just a sign of what a great storyteller he is that he allows the viewer to draw their own conclusions about this.
Right.
And I think if there's any place that you could say he has an agenda, it might be the end, but I don't think that's so much an agenda. I think that's that point. We know how angry Sheridan is, how furious he is about what's happened to Brother Edward when they accost the guy, when they finally capture the guy and down below, and he's proud of what he's done. The Boxlander's acting at that moment, I mean, that's great stuff. He doesn't even say anything, just he sets his jaw, and he's got this calm fury, and you know that he's going to kill the guy, and there's Zach going, no, Captain, settle down, you know? And Sheridan is wondering about, is what Brother Edward did, is that enough to atone for his sins? Was it necessary for atone for his sins? And then, of course, that's when Brother Malcolm shows up, and Sheridan, at that point, you know, he, like all of us, there's a time where you have to, you talk the talk, but then you got to walk the walk.
Well, as part of that too, it's left kind of open-ended. There's no, hey, I forgive this guy. It's me. I'm looking at that wondering, did Sheridan actually forgive him, or did Sheridan just look at this and say, okay, this is the ultimate irony?
I believe from the look on his face, you could tell he had a lot of anger about that situation, but there's nothing he can do to change it. B, he has to come to grips with it in his own terms, in his own time. And because of the respect he has for Brother Theo, he was going to hold his peace and not say a word.
Okay.
Because he doesn't have the right to take revenge on him for something he now doesn't remember doing.
Right.
Right.
So, I mean, it's literally can of worms.
I think that Sheridan, if not, at best, was giving the, you know, I forgive, but I won't forget. I think that by offering up his hand, he was, because Sheridan to me, he's an honorable character. He's not moralistic, and it's not so much that he takes the high ground, but he wants to do what's right. You look at how he handled all the situation with the Narn, given the battle cruiser sanctuary and Fall of Night, and because it was the right thing to do. And so I think this is one of those situations where, in my opinion, where he realized that, yeah, I've been talking about this, and now it's time for me to put my own words into action.
Well, and that's, I think, a very moralistic standpoint. I mean, that's going through, and moralism is basically doing what you know is right, regardless of how much you don't like it.
Okay. I'll accept that definition, and I think that's what Sheridan's doing. I think that's why he's doing it. It may not be, coming from his heart necessarily,
right?
But I think it's maintaining consistency.
Absolutely,
that he has in that character. Yeah,
yeah, absolutely. And part of the other thing I loved about this episode is the entire episode is just Grace. There's no black, there's no white in this whole episode. Even at the very end, right. You know, you've got the guy who's basically taking revenge, some would argue righteous revenge, you know, on this horrible killer, who then ends up and winds up in the same situation that the horrible killer does with the mind wipe and all that, after having committed the crime. And was that the right thing to do? I mean, is it right to take someone's memories away like that?
Well, I don't know. And to that same point, the methods that they use to get the information to catch the killers certainly skirted around the process of, you know, due process.
Oh, yeah.
You know, when they had the Centauri telepath, yeah, now he was being smug, but he's like, you guys can't do anything to me because you're going to need a telepath to get the information out, and the only telepaths you're going to have are human ones, and they're part of Psi-Corps, and they have rules. And they said, well, not really, and they bring Lita in.
Right.
And, you know, Garibaldi puts a bag over the guy's head. So, you know, they are, you know, there's another one to confront. On the side of those who were taking revenge against Brother Edward, they obviously felt the ends justified the means. They got their revenge. Is that where our command crew stands on this one? The end justifies the means. They want to save kind, goodly, saintly Brother Edward, and if we have to knock a few heads to do it, then we'll do it.
Right.
And does that make them really any better?
No, and it further forces that whole argument together of what makes the person. Is it the body or the mind or whatever? You know, and for different, and I think that's part of what's highlighted in this, is for different people, those criteria are different.
Yeah, and we see that and toward the beginning of the episode where Delenn comes to Garibaldi's office in the security area, and Garibaldi's listening to the ISN report about the killer who's getting mind wiped, and it's almost a sick glee on his face. The guy deserved it. You know, he's horrible and all, blah, blah, blah. And Delenn says, well, you know, she asked about the forgiveness, and Garibaldi says, well, I'm an eye for an eye kind of guy.
Right.
And Delenn says, so you promote a universe where we'd all be blind and toothless. and Garibaldi's response is, no, only the bad guys.
Right, yes.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, but there's the question, who are the bad guys?
Right, and Garibaldi at times seems to take a fine for me but not for thee type of attitude.
Exactly, yeah. So there's all kinds of, wavering stances throughout.
Right.
So, I really, like I said before, I enjoyed, this is one of my favorite standalone episodes of the entire series, just because it tackles these questions.
Well, and you mentioned some kind of holes and stuff, though, that you saw that got poked into it, right?
Well, there's a couple things that made me question. Well, rather, in the past, the episode has been, the story and the things have been so propulsive that there's a couple things that this time around I caught. Number one, the odd coincidence of Brother Edward dropping his bag but leaving the recorder on, that's, kind of flimsy little plot device there.
Okay.
That was, and combine that with that particular scene, the way it was directed, there wasn't a whole lot of dynamic camera angles in that. And for some reason this time around, I sat there watching Ivanova's facial expressions as she's reacting to this. Mm-hmm. This is really weird. You know, it looked like Claudia Christian was acting with a capital A. You know, I don't know. It was just really odd for some reason. The other thing that made me wonder this time around was Lita's involvement in the events.
Okay.
She, without any preamble, they are able to grab her, and she's quite willing to come in and basically stick a finger in somebody's head for, as far as Lita might know, no good reason. I mean, it would be one thing for Garibaldi to, you know, come in and say, look, you know, here's this really, really nice guy. We all love him. He's in trouble. Can you help? Not knowing enough about Lita's character at this point, we're not given enough to know why she'd want to do this sort of thing.
Well,
and this isn't, I mean, this is not something nice. Like, you know what, we need you to just kind of grab this information. It's like, you got to go in and start ripping at this guy.
Well, kind of correct me if I'm wrong here, but is this not the end of the episode where you find out that basically Lita's A biological containment suit?
Well, yeah, right. Yeah.
Okay. And yes. At the end of the episode, Lita walks in and Kosh leaves her body and goes back to the containment suit.
Okay.
So at this point, are we maybe dealing with more Kosh than Lita?
No. Well, hard to say because if you really recall, what we see is the scene where Ivanova greets Lita in the departure area, and it's been cleared out to keep it quiet.
Okay.
And she says, you know, so the implication is, you know, and they basically do a bit of an exposition. You know, the trial was very short. The guy didn't even, you know, was boastful. And she says, and says, you know, when I'm, you know, you weren't gone very long. And Lita says, yeah, these are, you know, short trips I take for the ambassador. So I hear what you're saying, Tim. Maybe at that point in time she had Kosh running around and Kosh would be more likely to be poking around, but that only begs the question, why would Kosh even want to get involved?
Well, and I would go through and turn around and say that the most orderly, as we know from foreshadowing, the Vorlons are kind of, or not from foreshadowing, but from later on in the series, the Vorlons are kind of this force of order in the universe. The most orderly way to deal with these people would be to either A, destroy them, or B, make them into completely different people who therefore added more order to the universe.
Yeah, but I would also argue that in the grand scheme of things, in terms of the great war that's coming and the darkness that is spreading across the galaxy, this is small potatoes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is something for the lesser races to deal with. I've got bigger fish to fry.
Yeah, okay.
But I wonder if he was just
to really spread the canon. Somebody's got to keep an eye on Galen, who's. If you read the Technomage novels, he's basically a walking time bomb. So,
well, anyway. See, I wonder. I always thought he was just observing. If he was in there when she did that, was he just watching? Was he helping?
Well,
at that point, was he there just to augment her powers? Because we know she's been. Well, we find out at the end she's been tweaked.
Right.
But we know, it's like, wait a minute, she's a P5. How can she be doing that to that Centauri?
Right.
And then you wonder, at the end, was that Kosh helping her learn her new abilities? Was she, you know, was she just trying them out?
Well, as you find out later on, Lita's been really tweaked.
Yeah, you find it. I mean, you kind of see, it's kind of obvious she's been tweaked.
Right.
But how much of that was her trying out her new abilities, and how much of that was Kosh maybe helping her say, hey, you can do this. You know, was he observing, or was he going, oh, by the way, you can do this, and really give him a headache he'll remember the rest of his life?
Right. Or both.
Yeah.
You know,
I don't know. It's still a kind of a...
Yeah, that's purely speculational. You know, stuff,
right, exactly.
Stuff I started, you know, wondering, like, the fifth time I watched the episode and was looking for the little things to nitpick about.
right. So some other nice elements. I like the scene with Delenn and Lanier and Brother Edward as he's recording information about Minbari spiritual beliefs and the idea of the non-locality of the soul.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, we hear a little bit about Valen. He's Minbari, but not born of Minbari, whatever that means. you know, the other thing that struck me is Brother Edward is very much like Lanier.
Yeah.
You know? Yes.
You know, wants to do good. He is, in essence, a you know, Brother Theo's right-hand man. You really kind of get that sense from this episode. Always has a special place with Brother Theo. You know, very unassuming, very mild-mannered. They're almost, you know, their voices had the same sort of inflection, and, you know, it was just kind of an interesting parallel between.
I hadn't noticed that. You know, two novices fresh out into the world after study.
Right.
I hadn't made that connection.
Yeah. They have that same kind of meek demeanor as they walk around, and oh, that's
right.
A good point.
Even Brother Edward, when he gets in the elevator, he gets in. You know, most people go, you know, brown 2, green 5. He's green 5, please.
Right.
You know, that's how That's how polite he is.
Yeah, that's a good point.
So, and that's great. I mean, that's great character stuff. I mean, Rad Dorff did a great job with the character, and, you know, that brings home the pathos of what he discovers later. Mm-hmm. The other thing that I liked is they didn't belabor the whole thing of what he was imagining. You know, they gave you, you know, a little taste of is it real or not, but then he doesn't shake it off. There's a scene with Brother Theo, and he says, "Are you all right?" And he goes, "No, I'm not."
Right. Yeah, you see his utter, you see almost his abject terror, even when the stuff's not showing up. You know, his bewilderment and just the way that he's dealing with life now is not nearly as centered as when he walked on the station.
Mm-hmm.
Correct. But he is still, he's not going to, I mean, it motivates him. He doesn't curl up into a ball at that point. You know, that's when he starts digging around in the records, and Brother Theo goes to Sheridan and says, "Well, you know, if I know Brother Edward, he's looking already."
Right.
And it's a fair bet that Brother Theo knew what his history was, although he you know, didn't tell Sheridan that. You know, he sort of played it close to his vest. It's like, you know, well, sometimes we get people in the order, we don't know what their past is. You know, no questions asked, and we don't have a whole lot of resources to dig around. But
no,
I don't know. You know, he says, "I don't know what he'll find," but I get the sense that Brother Theo had a pretty good idea.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'd agree with you wholeheartedly on that one.
Trying to think what other neat bits were in that. Oh, there's also the scene between Lita and Londo, which was just kind of an oddity in that episode. It was a fun scene, but didn't add a whole lot to the episode, I don't think. And I also liked the scene with the command staff when Lita first comes back and tells her story. And after she leaves with Dr. Franklin.
Right.
There's Garibaldi. And she leaves and says, "Is anybody else creeped out by this?" I'll just kind of raise her hand.
Yeah, everybody. Oh, yeah, I am.
There we have it. Any other things to discuss on Passing Through Gethsemane?
I think we covered about all of it.
Yeah, I think so too.
Well, in that case, we will take a very short break. I believe you will hear the next episode of Three-Edged Sword, after which we'll be back with some listener feedback.
This is Captain Yarstow, EAS Netherlands.
Area Planum, Command Post, reporting.
This is NBS-1, Squad Leader Tijan.
We are not hostile. I repeat, we are not hostile.
The Corps is mother, the Corps is father.
I will need to protect the interests of our people.
Battles we fought here at Orion 7 in the name of freedom. Three-Edged Sword. Episode 6. Preparations.
Personal log, Sierra Planum Command Post. The die is now cast. The Narn have made their decision, and I'm up to my ears preparing for the coming attack. The command staff is on board, after some initial grumbling. I think they're just annoyed they didn't come up with it themselves, and now have to share credit with Bester. The Earth Force positions have been logged, and will soon be transmitted to the Narn. They get half now, and the rest after the operation is complete. We have kept the sweetener secret. The command staff is duty-bound to reject such a breach of Psi-Corps policy. My classmate has been haunting MedLab, using her history of migraines as cover. The samples have been collected and, prepared, and loaded into the microprobe. Hyperspace interference in the fog of battle prep should mask its launch. We did make one concession to the Narn. The attack is being delayed until we move away from the vicinity of their base. While I'd prefer not to attack so close to Orion 7, there is one advantage. In the interim, Tijan is meeting Captain Yarstow on the Netherlands. I look forward to integrating his intel into our battle plan. End personal log.
Captain's log, EAS Netherlands, 72 days after secession. It's late now by our internal clocks, but the ship is as active as ever. Procedures are underway to allow the Narn leader Tijan to board our ship. Since we didn't bring any universal docking adapters for this mission, we're having to improvise with the fighter bay. It's not an ideal solution, but even with the Narn fighter sitting there, we should be able to launch all of ours. It will, however, take 5 or 6 minutes to launch the full fighter complement, rather than the 2 minutes it should normally take. The ships pursuing us seem to be holding their distance, a surprising decision given the fact that we're back on the beacon and on course for Orion 7 and the rest of our forces. Something our pursuers, certainly their capital ship, must have realized by now. I've asked Lieutenant Commander Jacobs to analyze the situation, using his combined expertise as a junior tactical officer and a fighter squadron leader. I'll attach his synopsis to this entry.
One attachment found.
Current tactical assessment. Lieutenant Commander Chris Jacobs reporting. Limits on enemy fighter endurance might have caused them to fall back and link up with their capital ship temporarily, but not for this long. Tactically, the enemy should try to attack us now, before we reach our allies, or give up completely if they don't think they have a chance. Holding this distance is probably indecision, unless they have allies of their own en route.
Squad Leader Tajan, personal log. This will be my last opportunity to add an entry to this log before boarding the Netherlands. I have sent all archives to base to ensure that our records remain intact. I have also attached all messages from Captain Yarstow and Agent 6 of the Psi Corps, along with my responses. All materials have, of course, been encrypted. Should we fail to return from Orion, then at least others will know our fate. The record will also make clear that this decision was mine alone. Should we fail to survive, then Narn must not suffer retaliation. Circumstances required action. If matters go well, our people will benefit. If not, the evidence will limit the damage done to our cause. I suppose, in the end, that I can ask for nothing more. After the struggle to escape Homeworld, the endless negotiations for support on Babylon 5, the cost of defending Sheridan against his own government, I cannot believe that all of our efforts, sacrifice, and bloodshed have brought us to this moment. May Jaquan forgive me if I was wrong. End personal log.
Free-Edged Sword is brought to you by Voices of Babylon.
And we are back with some listener feedback. And we have, what's the word I'm looking for? Oh yeah, a lack of voicemails this week, but a plethora of emails.
I would say a dearth of voicemails even.
Dearth. They've been
Wow.
An oodle?
A dearth.
You have an oodle of emails?
No, a bushel maybe.
A bushel. Perhaps a bushel and a peck.
Okay.
Well,
there's a great Jewish word I just learned. It's a, and forgive me if I say this wrong, I think it's called the shissel. Does anybody know this word? No, I'm serious. Do you know a shissel?
No.
You don't, do you?
No.
Okay, I'm telling you, I'm sure that there's some of our.
It sounds like a wacky 50s dance or something.
Sounds like Snoop Dogg.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Somebody shizzle.
Somebody right now.
A shizzle.
In the chat room, tell her on the feed. A shissel. Yeah, I think that's a large container worth of things, like a giant bowl full, like a basketball.
Well, it is not in metric fluid, I can tell you that.
A shizzle. Anyway, let's play our voicemail.
Let's play that first voicemail, I think. Yes?
Hey, wait. Uh-oh. I have one thing I want to mention. I got something else. There's more beef here.
Uh-oh.
Is it tainted beef?
No, it's age catching up with me and not remembering everything. In passing through Gethsemane, was that, in fact, the scene where I just remember I was in a scene, and I think that's the episode, where the monks had to, like, crawl down into this tiny little Sheridan had to climb down into a tiny little hole, like a place, and go talk. Is that the wrong episode?
That's the wrong monks episode. Was it Matters of Honor, I believe?
Yes. No, They're All the Honor Lies.
They're All the Honor Lies, right. I knew. This is the one that featured Brad Dourif.
Yes,
that
one.
Exactly. Yes.
No, I think that's the reason I mix my scenes, because I know where in the studio we shot that And it all kind of happens in the same place over and over, and that's what helps make it a big blur for me.
I never would have imagined that too many monks would confuse the Vorlon.
No, because I wasn't the Vorlon. No. I wasn't. I was
you were
the
one
guy
of the monks.
After a bunch of burlap that company pushed a little ball towards me, or I pushed the ball towards him, and he had to make
yeah,
a
Yeah, no, that's really. Okay,
that was
no,
you?
That's,
I'm the burlap.
You're the... You're the one who pushed the little bowl towards him. I did not know that.
Yes. Yes.
Wow.
You have no idea how much talent that I have pushing a bowl.
Well,
I
can see it being difficult to push a ball when you're covered in burlap.
Well, I can also hear Jeffrey. What's my motivation?
A paycheck.
Burlap is itchy.
I will say this about passing through Gethsemane. This is the first time where we see a more intimate view of the relationship between Lita and Kosh. So yes, was this the scene that kind of made the magic happen for you and Pat? With the lights coming out of her eyes and mouth going into the encounter suit?
But you guys are killing me. What episode number is this? No,
what
I'm sorry.
304?
What is it?
304, I
think it's 304.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, this is
still way before Walkabout. So this
yes.
is still
yeah,
the
right.
old. This
right.
is the old Kosh.
Yes, this is the old Kosh. Yeah. This is where Lita comes back on the
Classic
station.
Kosh.
Yes.
Right. Lita comes back. Yeah.
This is where you basically realize Kosh. That Lita's kind of like a rental car for Kosh.
Right, that's a good way to put it.
Okay.
Oh, poor yeah. Jeff. He's so lost.
I know.
Never mind. Let's roll that email. Voice
Hi guys, it's Edmund from Greenville. I want to go back in time and correct an ancient wrong, or at least one of my email responses in show 73. When Kathy Mary asked about the origin of the Triluminaries, I waffled on about time loops making your head hurt. If I'd been monitoring the chat room, I would have seen Yarstow and others reminding me that JMS is on record saying the Triluminaries came from the Great Machine. Now, what has confused me is when they were made, but I think I've finally got it. The Great Machine makes the Triluminaries and gives them to Delenn during War Without End. She gives them to Sinclair, who takes them back in time while using them to transform into Valen. Valen then establishes the Minbari religious prophecies, which keep them treasured and intact for use in Sinclair's interrogation and Delenn's transformation, 2 years before she first receives them. Just a preview of the feedback to come when you get to War Without End. Be seeing you.
Okay. Zapdos understand. No. Zapdos does not understand.
But Zathras do.
That was good at doing. Now here's, you know what, here I get to make a big, have you ever read David Gerald's novel, The Man Who Folded Himself?
No, I have not.
You wrote it in, I want to say, like 73 or 74. It's a very good book. I like it a lot. But in that, he postulates time travel. And how he does the time travel thing is, you, Summer Brooks, are in timeline A. You grab Babylon 4 and you head back in time 1,000 years. But you actually don't go back in time 1,000 years in timeline A. You actually pop over to timeline B at a point that's 1,000 years prior to a similar point on timeline A.
Okay.
You with me? So, in other words, then the next time you make a time travel, for example, you come forward in time, you're now in timeline B, and you're trying to steal Babylon 4 in the first place, you pop forward for 2 years, 3 years.
Into timeline C.
But, exactly. Right.
So you wind up with kind of these interleaving slanted timelines where you're just bridging from one to the other.
Correct. So in a sense, you know, you're not creating any time paradoxes because you're not back in the timeline that you started from originally to create the paradox.
Okay.
But that still doesn't answer. Yeah, at some point, the Triluminaries have to be originated, even if you're crossing timelines.
Well, and that's where your paradox comes in, yeah.
I think I just got confused more, so I'm going to, like, turn off my brain for a second and reset it.
Anyways, if you can find it, I'm sure it's out of print, but it's a very good book. I very much enjoyed it.
I have to make a note of that one. I believe you have a metric boatload of
Well, not quite a metric boatload of emails, but a fair number here.
A hogshead, perhaps?
First, what's that?
A hogshead, perhaps?
Possibly, yes. Let me see. Let me get out my hogshead and try to stuff it here.
I'm feeling archaic today for some reason.
Yeah, about half a hogshead.
Okay.
Okay.
Okay. So, all right, here we go. Let me wipe off the hog gut. Okay. Actually, this first bit is something from Gary in Jacksonville. He says, I thought I'd share some forum fun with you. I guess this is coming off the Babylon Podcast forum that I don't know that anybody associated with the show is paying any attention to.
Occasionally I drop by, and yes, they're a very active and chatty bunch.
Yes, they are. Actually, I kind of peeked a peek in, and apparently I've been acquainted with Bougie. So, believe me, it was quite a thread to read through. Okay, well, anyway, somebody commented on the forum. Can someone explain to me why JMS wouldn't come on the show now? He knows about the podcast. He remarked about it in a script book. Jeffrey is there, so he has a connection. And Summer and Tim have good sci-fi cred. And, of course, WB would be thrilled to get out the word to a site that gets so many hits. What am I missing? Seriously. So there is a response, and Brad, roll the drum roll. Number 10, JMS is really sorry that TLP is not a feature film. Number 9, he is sick of all the geek questions. It was just a show. Number 8, there is a time loop in which Jeffrey actually becomes JMS.
Yeah.
Number 7, Yarsto is really a DS9 fan and constantly monitors Farpoint Media to prevent JMS from revealing the truth. Number 6, JMS will not be recorded with that old mixer aboard of mics.
Ooh, that's probably the most likely one.
Number 5, JMS is waiting for Tim to get a high-speed connection.
Yeah, that's the one. Yeah.
Number 4, JMS will not let Summer interview him until she has bought all the script books.
Mm.
Number 3, Jeffrey showed JMS what was under the shower curtain and was never forgiven.
Oh, no.
Number At least two. He didn't say who was under the shower curtain.
Number 2, JMS might genuinely be too busy.
Nah.
And number 1, Warner Brothers is continuing its 10-year ban on B5 promotion.
I don't know that it's so much as a ban as sort of like a, oh, we still have that?
Right.
Yeah. Is that one of our shows?
Why is this still making money?
And then they go, oh, wait, no, it's not making money. We don't have to figure out the world. Oh, did I say that out loud? Yeah. Anyway, no.
Hey, come on, be nice to...
I'm being very nice because they sent us the DVD ahead of time, and I am so, so very grateful and giddy and happy about that. But no, JMS did respond to a couple of my emails, actually, and he said that he has plenty of platforms from which to speak. He's got the forums, he's got his own websites, he has said all he needs to say, and when he has to say more, he has platforms dedicated to that. He loves the fact that this show lets all of the other people who never got a chance to speak out about Babylon 5 while the show was on, it gives them a place to come and talk about it with fans who want to hear those stories. Because like he said before, there's a million stories out there, and we are a forum for some of those stories to get out.
Well, there we go.
Yeah, and that's so literally directly from the great maker's mouth or keyboard.
That's the case, maybe.
Or something.
Yes.
So, there we are. But I like that list. I thought that was fun.
I thought that was pretty good. I think number 7 was the Yarsto one?
Yeah.
That got me into thinking.
Uh-oh.
Oh, no.
Have you noticed that you've never really seen Yarsto and JMS in the same place at the same time?
Well, I was thinking you've never seen Yarsto and Cisco in the same place either, so...
Wondering if Yarsto is even a real person or just some kind of computer automated voice thing that Joe uses.
more advanced version of Stephen K. or Stephen Hawking wheelchair,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Right.
Okay.
We have more email, I hope?
Yes, we do.
Yes, we do, actually.
Okay, let's do that.
We have another email from Caitlin Stamper. Hey, guys, Caitlin from Kentucky again. In regards to a question about the perspective on sci-fi and Babylon 5 by a person who is my age, Tim is right. I'm from a generation that didn't grow up with Star Trek being the entire genre of American sci-fi on TV. Kids in their late teens like me had quite a number of shows that were available, shows like The Lost World, Xena, Hercules, Stargate, and of course Babylon 5, mm-hmm. and there was also DS9 and Voyager. For some reason, there seems to be a general consensus that people my age don't care that much about sci-fi, and I think that for the most part, that is wrong. Out of all the people I went to school with, about 10% like sci-fi, and of that 10%, about 8% rank Babylon 5 as one of their top two favorite sci-fi shows of all time.
Hmm.
With Stargate or Firefly usually taking the other spot. On another note, on the Kosh campaign front, I think that Jeffrey has Kentucky in the bag. I mean, with all the horse racing and the bourbon, I think that his tequila, all sex, all the time platform would go over really well here. I can see it now. KFC, Kosh fried chicken.
Oh,
wow.
And lastly, Tim, I would be happy to join your fan club / cult. You can count on me to be the first one to sign up to bring the tainted Kool-Aid to the meeting. What kind? Green apple flavor or purple grape? Green.
Purple.
Green. It's my fan club.
Don't start that again.
Okay, let's see. We have another email. This is from Asana Anderson. I just wanted to let you know that I love the fan fiction you guys have been getting and playing on your show.
Oh.
I'm a longtime listener, picked up after show 20, started listening from the beginning. I love the show. Well, we like hearing that. I'm so very happy that you're out there deep geeking on the show. I introduced B5 to my girlfriend a year ago, and now she's watched it 5 times.
Mm-hmm.
I really hope The Lost Tales DVD does well and they're able to continue the series. Well, keep up the good work, and I'm kind of worried when you get to the end of season 5 and the movies, what then?
Crusade.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I look at it this way. After the 5 years and after Crusade, Summer, you're probably going to go off and command a Warlock-class battle cruiser. We'll go on. And then about 20 years, we'll all come back together. We'll, have one last meal, and then I'll go beyond the rim, and that will be the end of it.
There you go. I still don't know in what order or when we're going to start covering the books.
We could do that. You could do that for a while.
Yeah, those are on the slate.
Then we could get into all the games, and then we could move on into comic books, and we could
see comic books. Yeah, but I never got into any of the games. Actually, I never got any of the games because I didn't have a machine that would play them because they were OG, not for the Mac.
Yeah, well, there's that. I've got this very odd board game that was. Kind of put together on the cheap, it looks like. The graphics aren't particularly involved. And it seemed to be sort of a precursor to the collectible card games. The set I've got is the Minbari set, and apparently there's one for all the various major races, plus the League of Non-Aligned Worlds. And, you know, glancing through it, you determine what areas in your space are bases and producing what sort of ships and that kind of stuff, sort of a strategic diplomacy kind of game, not so much of a war game, but I'd never seen the like, so I don't know. I guess I'll have to take a photo and post it up on the blog and see if anybody else recognizes it.
I'm drawing a blank now on who the game maker was for that one. Nope. Senior moment, never mind. Senior. Let's drink some more.
That's okay. Like I said, it's kind of fairly obscure. And then, you know, when it comes down to it, we can, you know, take shows going through and discuss characters more in depth and that sort of stuff. So I think we'll be doing the show for quite a while. I don't think there's going to be a problem with that.
Oh, yeah. We have plenty of material and plenty of time to get to all of it. So
plus, the three of us could retire and bring in three new hosts, and they could just start all over with, like, an accurate perspective.
There you go.
Well, that will do it for this episode of the Babylon Podcast. If you would like to send an email that Tim can read on the air, that email address is babylonpodcast@gmail.com. Or if you want to call in and leave a voicemail message, that number is 206-338-2259. That's 206-338-2259.
Here are the lost tales dropped into the FedEx mailbox.
And we'll see you next time on the other side of the gate.